I don't know what's real. I don't know what's not real.
Limited Capacity is a collection of six darkly amusing stories about the mysterious ways we interact with the internet and with each other.
There's something going on with him. It's like an act. I don't trust him.
What?
You're staring at me like I should say something, but I don't really know what to do here.
That's the whole name of the game. Don't talk about how the town isn't real. Do you understand?
Limited Capacity. Available now on CBC Listen or wherever you get your podcasts.
This is a CBC podcast.
Hey, listeners, if you like our podcast, you should check out Ethnically Ambiguous from How Stuff Works.
A podcast about the immigrant minority experience. Iranian-American Anna and Syrian-American Shireen walk you through being a modern Middle Easterner in today's climate.
They discuss everything from discovering sexuality within immigrant families to stereotypes about Middle Easterners that may or may not be true, and tell you stories to help you make sense of all the news coming out of the Middle East.
You can listen to Ethnically Ambiguous on your favorite podcast app or wherever you get chosen family.
We all have a history of experience that lives inside of us. We all have emotions that impact the way that we view the world, right? So that vision becomes this combination of the eyes, the heart, and the brain.
Welcome to Chosen Family. I'm Trana Winter.
And I'm Thomas LeBlanc. That was filmmaker Rodney Evans you just heard.
Rodney has an eye condition called retinitis pigmentosa. His latest film, Vision Portraits, is a really beautiful and personal documentary that explores the challenges and strength of visually impaired artists.
We'll get to talk to Rodney in a little bit. Plus, later, a very special edition of Obsessions with writer-director Cindy Shupak of Sex and the City. Trina, my gaydar recently failed me.
Oh, no. What a horrible situation.
I know. I hit on a straight man. It never happens to me. I'm usually pretty good at knowing if I have a chance to...
There are still straight men there, in the world?
I mean, I know. That's a good question. So recently I met this guy named Chris. He's actually the inventor of the hashtag. That's like, that's okay. His big claim to fame in San Francisco in 2007.
Did he monetize that?
No, I know, but it makes him kind of cooler. So I hung out with him at some talk here in Montreal, and then we went for dinner after with the people organizing the talk. And okay, so Chris is like polyamorous. He's from the West Coast. He's a tech guy, but he's not a tech bro in like the convention. Like, that's so obvious that they're usually straight. But he had nail polish on that night, and that really threw me off. I went directly to, oh, he's queer. Like, there was no question in my mind that he was queer. So we just walk after the restaurant, and I'm like, oh, like what? Like, I was just trying to know because I was curious. Turns out, super straight. I was just like baffled by my assumption. I was doing what I usually hate people do. You know, like I don't.
Making assumptions.
Yeah,
you
exactly.
Hate people making assumptions.
Yeah, exactly.
So do I. But and I know we're all trained to do that. And I think we're in this moment right now of sort of like trying to unlearn that instinct of making assumptions about someone based on how they look or how they're presenting. But I do think it's interesting to sort of, in that context, like, examine what it means to be queer. And I think you can be straight and be queer because, to me, queer is so much about a kind of spirit and point of view or vision, if you will, than it is about sexuality.
It got me thinking that a lot of my straight friends are actually super queer, and a lot of my gay friends are pretty normative.
Couldn't agree more.
And it's fine.
And sometimes it angers me, though. Sometimes it angers me when I see especially cis gay white men who are living these like very heteronormative lives, because there's a part of me that feels, and I don't think I even fully deliver on this, so I'm sure part of my anger that I direct towards them is actually directed to myself, because I feel like as queer people, there is a kind of responsibility to be radical, to be punk, to use your space in the world to create change and sort of dismantle convention.
Right. And even though being queer is the one fundamental thing about me, like more than being Quebecois or a comedian or whatever, sometimes I don't feel queer enough. For some reason, for me, queerness has to be this like very creative, unique, special, individualistic journey. and I'm just a guy. I'm just a dude. I love to wear shorts, and it's fine. And I know it's fine, but there's also this part of me that's like, oh, I should be more daring in the ways I present.
I feel that same thing. Like when I see like trans women with full on beards, yeah, and I love it, and they rock it, and it looks great. But it personally, like, I wouldn't feel confident in my best self. I'm really at a point where I'm trying to figure out, like, do I want to transition in a traditional sense? You know, like, do I want to be on hormones? And I feel like until I can really answer that question super clearly for myself, I don't want to really do anything.
Do you feel there's a pressure within the queer community or the culture at large for trans people to transition physically?
Yeah, absolutely. I think there's a lot of trans women who have, you know, medically transitioned who sort of regard, I think they would regard me as like a cross-dresser. You know, like there would be this like, you know, there is that tension in the
trans community.
Do you
feel that they would not, that they would see you as someone who's not trans enough?
Yeah, okay. Absolutely. Absolutely. But I mean, luckily I'm at a point in my life where I have a certain amount of self-awareness and confidence that I'm not someone whose will is very easily bent, you know? I know who I am. Yeah. I just need to get my laser hair removal. Like, it's really the facial hair that, like, fucking drives me insane. And, like, the busier that we get and, like, the more that we do and, like, I'm half Middle Eastern, so it grows back fast. And
you had
like,
I remember when I first saw you had a Cinderella joke.
Yeah, like I have to be home by the stroke of midnight before my beard starts growing back. It's like, it's a joke, but it's also true. And like, yeah. But I feel like there are a handful of people in my life, like you and other close friends, that I feel so seen, you know? And also, like, one thing, I might get emotional again, but so I was in Fido's Summer Pride campaign. It's a campaign about embracing courage and vulnerability. And there is a video component that was online, and my mom showed it to my grandmother, and I wasn't expecting my grandmother to see it. And my grandmother knows that I'm trans, but I don't feel like she fully understands what that is, and it's something that I haven't really been willing to sit down and explain because the idea of it just makes me so uncomfortable because I know that my grandmother loves me no matter what, so I don't feel like I need to have that conversation. But she called me after seeing the video, and I think it was the first time that she, like, really got it. And she was like, I've never been more proud of you in my life. So that was, like,
that's great.
I wasn't expecting it. Because I think also, like, even though I know that she loves me no matter what, like, I didn't know what her capacity for understanding what it really means was, you know? And then she started talking to me about, like, what are you going to wear to your sister's wedding? Like, you know, like, you have to get a dress. Like, and I was kind of dreading my sister's wedding because I'm like, how am I going to dress? Like, how do I navigate this situation? So I just feel like relieved. You know, when the people that really matter to you really see you, that's all that matters. So I can't believe that moment happened as a result of, like, the Fido campaign.
A corporate like, sponsorship of, yeah, pride.
it made the conversation happen, and I didn't even need to, that's, like,
that's
make
an
the
advertiser's,
conversation happen.
That's an advertiser's dream.
But there's a part of me that's so relieved that, like, I mean, knock on wood, my grandmother's super healthy and, like, you know, is in great form, but she's getting older. You know, my grandmother's 85. So I just feel really grateful that I will know that no matter when that time comes, that my grandmother knew who I was.
I went to this ophthalmologist, and they basically were like, you have this very rare eye condition. You gradually get more and more blind. I feel like I'm just looking for guidance in how to be a blind artist.
I remember waking up one morning, getting around the city. I really couldn't read subway stops. Obviously, I was really terrified.
When you first enter the idea that you're going to lose your sight, it feels like a terminal point, you know, that you're going to go to this place called blindness and that's where you stay. But there is something on the other side. It's a different point of view.
You know, I came out of the hospital, and my mother said, "Oh, sweetheart, we were so proud of your career." And I thought, what makes you think I'm not going to take pictures anymore?
Vision Portraits is a meditative documentary that follows four visually impaired creators: choreographer Kayla Hamilton, photographer John Dugdale, writer Ryan Knighton, and the filmmaker at the center of it all, Rodney Evans.
Starting in the late 90s, Rodney has been making groundbreaking work that often confronts the confines of gender and sexuality. His first feature film, Brother to Brother, was a fictional account of how a young gay black man meets a survivor of the Harlem Renaissance. His second feature, The Happy Sad, came out in 2013. It follows two young couples exploring the boundaries of their own relationships and identities.
We got to talk to Rodney about Vision Portraits and asked him why this time he decided to turn the camera on himself alongside the other artists.
At a certain point, it just became very clear that I was having certain conversations with these specific artists, and there was a certain trust and intimacy and an insider knowledge about being visually impaired that we all had in common, and that if a fully sighted filmmaker was making this film, they would get very different kinds of answers. And so because of the nature of the conversations, like, it needed to be acknowledged that I was part of this community and, in fact, a visually impaired filmmaker, and had been making work as a visually impaired filmmaker for over two decades.
It's a beautiful piece of film. It's both experimental, it's personal, it's documentary.
I want to talk about your relationship with Ryan, the writer Ryan Knighton. He has the same diagnosis as you.
Yes.
Which is retinitis pigmentosa.
Uh-huh.
He got his at 18. You were mid-20s when you got yours?
Yeah.
So what exactly is that diagnosis?
It basically means that your retina is deteriorating, and, you know, that usually manifests itself in loss of peripheral vision and loss of night vision at the beginning. You know, there are kind of two dominant strands of it. One is the kind that Ryan has, which progresses kind of rapidly over the course of 6 to 8 years, and nothing seems to kind of stabilize it. And then the strand that I have is you kind of lose a lot of your peripheral vision. You have, you know, minimal night vision, but it plateaus until you get much older, until maybe you're like in your 70s or something, and then it'll start to deteriorate. So there are a lot of medications and regimens and things that people recommend that you do to maintain the vision that you have. There's also just a lot of newer technologies and experiments happening now.
One really interesting tension in Vision Portraits is the tension between vision and sight. And mm-hmm. I'm an able-bodied seer, whatever.
Fully sighted person.
Fully sighted person, is that what the term is?
Yeah.
At what point did you realize that it's not because you're losing your sight that you're losing your artistic vision?
You know, I think that that probably happened or was reinforced through the making of this film.
Recently as that?
Yeah. I mean, I don't think it ever equaled the loss of artistic vision for me. Mm-hmm. If anything, it was kind of beneficial to me. And that's something that I say in the film, and that when you're on set and you're working with actors, like, sets are very chaotic places, right? And so I had this condition that basically gives me tunnel vision. It's my job to really focus on the actors and to know what the actors are going through. It's not my job to know, like, that the lighting rig is not properly set up. Like, that's somebody else's job,
right?
And so, like, I'm literally not seeing that. Like, I'm literally tunneling out all of that stuff and focusing on what the actors are doing. We are literally, like, in a literal and figurative bubble, you know?
Do you feel you have to come out as a visually impaired artist sometimes?
Yeah, for sure.
Years ago, let's say, when you started your career as a filmmaker, it was more an issue for you. You say that in the documentary about the industry. But it sounds like today you're way more comfortable.
Yeah, I'm less concerned with just like how the industry views me. Okay. Like, I just don't care, to be honest. And so I was always aware of the fact and was told by producers that I should never say that I'm visually impaired. Yeah.
You should stay in the closet.
Yeah. That would literally be like the thing that prevented me from getting work.
Really? Really? Yeah. But the way you see the human face, you describe in the movie as seeing a face as a landscape.
Yeah.
And I think it's quite beautiful. Do you feel people relate differently to the material because they know you see differently?
Well, I don't think that, frankly, it's inherent or knowable in the actual material that I am a visually impaired director. Like, when I made Brother to Brother, I was visually impaired. When I made my second feature, The Happy Sad, I was visually impaired. So, you know, I mean, just the nature of filmmaking, you are composing a shot through a small monitor, right? So I'm taking in the entire frame of what the camera is seeing through this monitor. I'm working with the cinematographer to compose the shot. But my primary focus is the emotion that the actor is going through in that particular scene and whether they are where they need to be. And if they're not, what I need to do as a director to get them there. And that's the one thing that nobody else on set is responsible for. So for me, it's just a given that we're all going to have certain obstacles that we need to overcome to make work. And you know, if the industry just needs to kind of catch up, then so be it, you know. And I do think that there is a long way to go in terms of disability vis-a-vis the film and television industry.
In Vision Portraits, you know, the four of you collectively are sort of facing similar obstacles. But the common thread between you is that there is this commitment to your artistry. And you wrote that your aim in making the film was to, you know, arrive at a deeper knowledge. A knowledge of what for you? Like, in profiling these artists and illuminating them, it was a knowledge that fed into what sort of aspect for you?
For me, the knowledge that I gleaned was an expanded definition of what vision is, right? That it's not just this ocular thing. That's very mechanical, that you look at things and take in information and that's that, right? That we all have subjective points of view. We all have a history of experience that lives inside of us. We all have emotions that impact the way that we view the world, right? So that vision becomes this combination of the eyes, the heart, and the brain, right? And that all of those things are kind of integral to the process of vision and creating meaning out of what you see, literally, like when you're going about your everyday experience and life. And so I think a lot of people don't think about vision in that way. They just merely think about it as like just taking in information through their eyes.
Right.
I don't think that before I made the film, I could articulate what I just articulated to you as clearly as I did.
But you knew that you were looking for something.
Yeah.
There was a piece of the knowledge missing for you.
Sure. I was looking for a way to continue making films if this condition that I had progressed even more to the point where, you know, maybe I wouldn't be able to see the emotion on actors' faces really clearly. Or maybe, I don't know, just it was literally like, what are you going to do besides be sitting around in a pool of self-pity?
Right.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, how are you going to continue to make work in a very concrete way? And here are these people that do it. I want to talk to them.
And before, did you think of yourself as a person that should something like this happen, that you would have the strength to rise to the occasion? I know for me, sometimes very selfishly, think I'm just too weak. Like, I don't think I could handle it.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting to me because I think that people have resources of strength that reside in themselves that they don't know they have until they're called on. So I'll just put that out on the table. And I'll say that, you know, I was diagnosed so young that that I was a bit of like a, you know, punk rock shit kicker. You know what I mean? Like, I wasn't like waiting for permission from anyone to do anything. Like, I made a feature about LGBT strippers in Los Angeles, predominantly in the African American and Latino communities. And then this older woman who had this museum called the Exotic World Museum, and she would do these homages to like the history of burlesque. I shot it, I edited it, interviewed all of the actors. It was like literally being a one-man show. And I would just go to those clubs and like go backstage and, you know, get into like scuffs with bouncers. And, you know, it was hardcore. Yeah. And like, so I think there was a certain kind of denial at the beginning where I was just like, I need to make work.
You know, when we think of film, we automatically tend to think of visuals. We watch films. But sound has the potential to take this from a whole other angle.
Yeah. For example, with this film, there's a very rich audio description, right? And so I worked really in close collaboration with the writer and the recordist of the audio description to really talk about like how the visual language was being translated into words,
right,
and what the tone would be of like how she was saying them. And it was a performance, right? And I directed it just like I would direct any performance, which I think is new ground. Like most people, when they do an audio description, it's sort of dealt with in the way that closed captioning is dealt with. Like the film is done, it gets farmed out to some place that the distributor sends it to, and then it comes back with this track that you had nothing to do with, that maybe is awful, that maybe you don't like the language of, that maybe the person is stiff and robotic. So there are these kind of automatic ways that people have been doing things that need to be challenged, right? And so I met someone who wrote a whole book about audio description and was like, I'm like blind and these things suck. And I was in the audience and I was like, hello, I'm a filmmaker and I'm gonna do one of these audio descriptions. Do you have any tips for someone to make one that doesn't suck? And she was like, stay involved. Collaborate with the person that's doing it. Don't let them just tack it on at the end. You know what I mean? There are all of these things that were that are just being done kind of pro forma, like this is how we do it, where it doesn't have to be that way. So it's just it's like a learning curve, right? I feel like the industry is just catching up.
This is such a phenomenal example, and I've never thought of that.
Yeah.
For sure your work is not going to be appreciated the same way if it's just like this bland description of what's happening.
Yeah, no, and it was really a in reaction to so many people in the blind and visually impaired community just being like, those audio description tracks suck. Like, please don't do one of those horrible ones. Like,
I guess it just blows my mind that such an enormous part of the population has been disserviced to this extent. And I just, because now there's such a push for queer stories and queer voices, which is fantastic, and it took a long time to get here. But we also basically represent 10% of the population.
Sure.
And so I'm just baffled by how we got to this point where such a substantial percentage of people have been left out of the cultural story.
Yeah, no, I will say I find it astonishing as well. And you know, every time I say it's the last bastion, it seems to be like one other, you know, something else that needs to be grappled with.
Yeah. We were talking about, you know, the importance to be seen and how significant that is.
Absolutely.
Because when you're not seen, there's the feeling that you are not worth anything.
Yes.
And I know that that's a driving force behind vision portraits.
Absolutely.
And allowing people to be seen.
Yeah.
And it's so moving and it's so powerful. And I think these stories tend to be niched, you know, people like queer content tends to be geared and marketed towards only queer people.
Right.
But it's like, no, these are universal stories. I like even watching Ryan and even watching Vision Portraits, there's so much that I connect to. And I think one of the things that I connected to the most strongly actually is something that you mentioned at the end of Vision Portraits about your relationship to the idea of romantic love,
mm-hmm.
and the way that you feel that, you know, having your cane or, you know, coming out as visually impaired, that there's a feeling or an expectation that whoever might become involved with you in a romantic sense,
yeah.
would have to become a caretaker. And you just straight out say that that's unsexy and that's not a sexy thing for people.
Right.
Where are you at with that right now? Is love still something that you're hopeful about, or do you feel like it's something you've been denied?
No, it is something that I'm hopeful about. And, you know, I'm dating and I'm, you know, I'm out and about.
Yeah.
So it's not like something that...
Because I felt in the documentary kind of like you felt like this door was closed.
Did you project trying to...
A little bit, yeah. But I also felt like saying, I'm like, there are other things.
Yeah, I mean...
But so, I don't know if it's something that you, like, attach a lot of importance to in your life.
Yeah, I mean, I think, funnily enough, I think as I've gotten older, it's become more important that, like, I feel like for, you know, a long time, my work was, like, a lot, you know what I mean? Like, it took a lot of, like, fighting, frankly, a lot of, like, kicking down of doors. And that usurps a lot of your time and your energy. And so I just felt like I didn't know where that person would fit into that
right.
landscape.
And now there's room?
Yeah.
Now the door
yeah.
is open?
Yeah, the door is open for sure.
Listeners out there.
Yes, the door is open. You know, if anything, like I just, my hope would be that the film would sort of expand ideas of disability within the queer community and... you know, dismantle some of those ideas about, like, what is sexy and what is vulnerability. And, I mean, and the fact of the matter is that I don't need a caretaker. You know
yeah,
what I mean?
Exactly.
And that I'm, like...
That's clear.
Yeah, and that I'm pretty, like, independent and am fully functional and able to teach and make some independent films and get them out into the world and do a lot of things on my own.
You know what? You know? I think that's actually really hot.
It is. It is. It's so attractive.
It is.
Most... fully able-bodied people cannot get their shit together the way that you have.
Well, thank you.
Rodney, thank you so much for doing this.
Oh, it's my
pleasure.
It's
been such a joy.
Oh, it was
thank
so much
you.
Fun.
And
yeah. Thank you, guys.
Yeah, so much success for
yes.
the film and
oh,
everything
totally.
That's coming next.
Oh, thank you. Thank you for having me.
Rodney Evans. Vision Portraits is popping up in select theaters in North America this month. Check it out if you can. It's really quite beautiful. Obsession.
Obsession. What are you obsessed with?
What am I obsessed with? And Trana, today you got a really special obsession that you're going to share with us.
Yes. So, I mean, you know, and anyone who's been listening to Chosen Family knows that I am completely obsessed with Sex and the City and have been... from a time when I was probably too young to be watching it. Like, I started watching it when I was 13. I don't know. I'm forever drawn to these women, the characters as well as the actresses themselves. To me, there's just something so compelling about them. And, you know, my high school years, like we kind of explored in the Margaret Cho episode, it was basically Sex and the City and Margaret Cho that kind of got me through. And so I think there's also that really keeps me attached to the show. Like, I still go through the whole series at least twice a year.
I can't stand when people are like, which Sex and the City character are you? Like, are you a Samantha? Are you a Charlotte? Like, I can't.
No.
That's too basic.
It's too basic.
And I'm basic, but that's too basic for me.
It is too basic. And the more important question is, what is your favorite Sex and the City episode? That is a much more important and more revealing question
right.
to ask someone.
I don't think I have a favorite Sex and the City episode. I have favorite Sex and the City boyfriends, but no episode.
For me, there's this one episode in the show that has always kind of haunted me because I'm not sure what that episode was really trying to say, and it was a lot darker than the other episodes.
Oh, I don't think I know this about you. I'm so curious.
And I couldn't believe one of the main writers on the show and executive producer, Cindy Shupak, was coming to Montreal, and I was just like, we need to get Cindy into Chosen Family so I can finally ask her about this episode.
Yeah, Cindy is pretty iconic. She also just directed her first feature film, Otherhood, and you got to talk to her about it.
Cindy, welcome to Chosen Family. I am so excited that you're here. I'm such a big fan of your work.
Aw, thank you. Thank you for having me.
Congratulations on Otherhood.
Thank you.
I love the premise of the story. So it's these three friends who are moms, and they're sort of having this empty nest moment in their lives. Their grown sons are off and living their lives, and they sort of come, these three women come together and decide to just show up at their son's doorsteps and sort of reinsert themselves and kind of start mothering them again.
It sounds like a horror movie when you describe it. Depending on your perspective on your mom.
Yeah, for sure.
But it's kind of, it's a dramedy. And it's, you know, starts on Mother's Day and they just feel kind of marginalized and forgotten. And so they go to New York to make their sons love them again. But they realize, it's really a journey for the women because they realize they need to figure out who they are and what their lives are now. When I first started working on this 10 years ago, I wasn't a mom. And then in the interim, I'm a late in life mom, but we adopted our daughter at birth. And so she's 8 now. So now I relate in a whole other way of someday she will not want to see me.
Okay, so that's already on your mind.
Yes.
You're already anticipating that moment.
I am at once enjoying every moment and mourning every moment.
You've assembled such an incredible cast for this film. Angela Bassett, Felicity Huffman, Patricia Arquette. What was it like to work with these amazing women and actors?
It was an honor and intimidating as my, directorial debut and features. But it helped me so much because I knew they could do anything and I knew they had the depth and the gravitas to make the moments real and land, which is what I really wanted. And they enjoyed working together. I mean, the thing about, I'm in this group of women showrunners and we get together every so often and we talk about what's hard in our lives or how things are going. And one of them, Betsy Thomas, who created My Boys, she said, like, I was talking to her and I said, how have we never worked together? And she said, because there's usually only one of us on a show.
Right.
I mean, not even as showrunners, even if we're just a writer, we'll get like one high level woman on a show. So I think it's the same for these actresses sometimes. They don't get to be in an ensemble of equal characters. And they really enjoyed it and enjoyed playing female friendship.
Oh, I'm so glad we're still doing this. Without husband and kids, it might actually be fun.
I brought donuts.
Oh. I brought bourbon. Like, I'm really going to drink a mimosa. It's Mother's Day. I knew I should.
You've done, some incredibly iconic work and have worked on so many shows. I don't want to leave any out. Divorce, Better Things, Modern Family, Everybody Loves Raymond, I'm Dying Up Here, and of course, Sex and the City. I'm a diehard Sex and the City fan, like almost everyone. There is a specific episode that I really want to talk to you about.
Okay.
It's Splat.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Do you remember?
Of course.
Kristen Johnston had an amazing cameo on that show playing Lexi, the aging, tragic party girl.
New York is over. O-V-E-R.
One of the best lines in TV ever. I'm so bored, I could die. And then falling out the window. Like, I mean, it's so brilliant.
Yeah.
I'm so bored I could die.
But what I think is so interesting about that episode, and it's something in regards to the show, just a question that has always sort of like lingered with me when I watch that episode. So basically, we have Candace Bergen, who plays Enid, the high power Vogue editor, who, you know, on paper has achieved everything, is fabulous, confident, strong woman. Then there's the party that she's throwing that she needs a date for.
Uh-huh.
And she has this moment where she has to ask Carrie to find her a date. And it's sort of this like humiliating moment for her. And the best that Carrie can do is the
Wallace Shawn.
Yeah, Wallace, who is amazing. But, you know, sort of presented as this like hobbitish food critic.
Anyway, I'm just a huge fan of the pomegranate.
Do either of you have a light?
The party scene happens. Lexi dies. They're all at the funeral the next, the week or whatever after. And then when Carrie sees Enid going to the funeral arm in arm with the food critic, there's this moment where you kind of like, it's sweet, but then it's like, is she settling? And then
right.
Carrie turns to the girls and she says, ladies, if you are single in New York after a certain point, there is nowhere to go but down.
Yeah.
And I'm just so curious about what that line meant to you or what you were trying to say with it. Because there's a part of me that like, whenever I watch it, I kind of feel like, oh my God, like, is it only okay to be single up to a certain point? And then after that, it's not okay.
Well, I think that was where, it's so funny, I remember all this like yesterday. I mean, that's what Carrie was feeling then, and she wanted to go to Paris, right? So she had created a narrative for herself that she New York was starting to be over for her, and there wasn't, and she didn't even bring her computer, if you remember.
Yeah.
So she was kind of cutting ties, in a way, with everything that made her her. And then I think at the end, she realizes she's not done with New York or writing or anything. So so I don't think that's true. I think she was feeling that at that moment. And you have those moments where you feel like your life is over or it's all down from here. But I think she was wrong about that.
So you feel like it was really a Carrie-specific thought and not like the message of the show, or the show going against its message of like celebrating singlehood and choices.
Yes, I think it was just her, you know, rationalizing going away.
Right.
Leaving. She was breaking up with New York. You say some mean things, you know?
Yeah. And you want to justify it.
Yes.
You want to justify that breakup in your mind.
Yeah. And if you're a diehard, you may remember or you may know that I started dating a guy who I'm married to now, Ian. He was really into cheese. He was into raw milk cheddar, and New York has just as good cheeses, and he was always talking about cheese. And I told him I was going to use that for a character. And he was thinking, who's going to date this cheese guy, and who will the cheese guy? Will Robert Downey Jr.? And it was Wallace Shawn, and it was kind of like a nerdy thing that he knew all about cheese. And my husband, who's pretty cool and like rides a motorcycle, and so the fact that she ended up with Wallace Shawn, who talks about cheese, you know, there's an upside to those people too.
I love that that's the story behind that. And I feel like Carrie was this symbol of like singlehood and that being fabulous. But I think like all along, like, I don't know how comfortable Carrie ever was with being single. Like, she seems to me, especially as I watch it, as I get older, like, no, she really wants to be partnered.
Uh-huh.
I don't think she loves being single as much as we've loved celebrating her singlehood.
Well, there's kind of a theme like that, I think, in my new movie, too, in Otherhood, that there are, I mean, when I started working on Sex and the City, it felt that being single was kind of a stage between, you know, while you're waiting to meet the person, as
right.
opposed to a stage unto itself that could be fabulous. Because, like, my mom married young. She didn't ever own her own apartment or get to sort of figure out who she was without a man, which we get. And sometimes we get it for longer than we might like. And some people get it and love it and never, you know, want to or need to partner up. But I think that need for love or for someone who can compliment your life, like come into your life and not make it smaller, but make it bigger or just enjoy it with you. It's pretty natural. And we would debate a lot in the writer's room if we were, even at the end of the show, for sure, you know, if we were betraying what we were trying to say, if they still wanted love or needed love. But I think wanting love and needing it are two different things. And I think she wanted it.
Yeah.
And in Otherhood, the women are at the stage where their children are growing up. They're not mothers. They have to kind of look around, and suddenly everything you distracted yourself by when you're just a nurturer and a provider and also a wife, and they have this moment to look around and say, well, who are my friends? And what is the state of my relationship? And what is my relationship with my child? And what do I want my life to be? And I hope that Otherhood kind of can become that sort of stage, too, that it's not just the end of your years as a mother, but an actually potentially fabulous time where you can still have a lot of life and a new career or do things you always wanted to do.
Cindy, it was such a joy to have you here today and to meet you and talk to you about all of this.
Oh, thank you. Thanks for having me.
It's been the biggest pleasure. Thank you so much.
Cindy Shupak. You can watch her new film, Otherhood, on Netflix. So, Joanna, did this satisfy you?
It really did. And honestly, I could have spoken to Cindy for like 5 hours. And I'm so glad that I got to resolve the issue of that episode, because that episode for so long to me has felt like such a betrayal of the message of the show. I think now I can just fully appreciate the brilliance of that episode on its own without being plagued by what felt like a slap in the face to single people.
Right.
After our interview, though, we did talk a little more, and she gave me some juicy information that I'm not really allowed to share. But there might be a little something that I'll post in the Chosen Family Facebook group, so you guys need to get on over there.
Join the Facebook group. Trana loves moderating the Facebook group, you guys. Chosen Family is produced by me, Thomas LeBlanc.
And me, Trana Winter, with Crystal Duhame. Crystal also edits and mixes the show.
She makes us sound so good.
she's the best.
Our talent producer on this episode was Catherine Stockhausen. Also, a big thanks to the Inside Out Festival in Toronto.
Chosen Family's music is by The Lost Boys.
Judy C. Gu is our digital producer. Tanya Springer is the senior producer of CBC Podcasts. And Arif Narani is the executive producer. Chosen Family is a CBC podcast originally developed in association with Phi Studio.
Listen to Chosen Family wherever you get your podcasts and tell your friends to listen too.
For more CBC podcasts, go to cbc.ca/podcasts.